I'm Haley from Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 138 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where tonight we're going to cue up a soundtrack of the relative current day's most popular songs as we embark on a madcap romp across an alien world like so many Scooby-Doo chase scenes. Scooby-Doo. The memory of that takes me back, or forward. Well, it's hard to keep that straight. Here in the GPR studios this evening, the vacuous GPR studios... my name is Kieran. Joining me is my partner in time, Jay. How are you this evening, sir?
I am doing fantastic. How about you?
All right. I'm pretty good. Haley, we have shipped off to another state, and we're leaving her there and see if she can find her way back.
Yeah, she decided she was going to spend the weekend at Dallas, Fan Expo? I don't know. There's so many of them, I can't keep them straight. So she'll actually be back next week with the audio that she got from, I think she said, Karen Gillan and... Sylvester McCoy, I think she said. I don't know. She put a bunch of stuff in the box.
Yeah, she was mentioning a quick drop in with Billy Piper, but I'm not sure if that has audio to back it up. I think she might have just been able to bounce a couple of questions off of her. We'll see. We'll find out when she gets back. We'll hold her accountable for all of her failures.
Yeah. All right.
So what's going on this week?
This week, we examine the use of popular music in Doctor Who, from the Beatles appearing before the First Doctor in the 1960s, to the Master playing I Can't Decide by the Scissor Sisters, to Fox's soulful remake of the Queen song in Series 8, and then the upcoming appearance of One Direction in Series 9. At times, the score of the program is more than just the genius composition of Murray Gold. So we have to ask, is there a qualified place for it? Or, like many other popular shows, both in the UK and the US, is this just an effort to build viewership based on another industry's popularity?
Mm. That's kind of a key point out of all of this is, a lot of times if you want to look back to any series you choose on whichever side of the Atlantic that you're referencing, as soon as you start to hear a pop tune being used or you've got some scene that on their way out as everyone's walking down the corridor at the end of some moment that they've had or two people are looking thoughtfully at one another and the score kicks in and you realize, oh, wait, okay, this isn't our usual composer. This is a song I know. This is an artist I know. And you think, well, a lot of effort went into getting the rights to using this song. It was specifically chosen to underscore this moment in this program. Was it worth the effort, and what was the intention all along? Is it being done because it is the right piece to convey the right emotion at the right time? Or is it, as Jay just mentioned, is this something where you're trying to say, you know what, we need to make sure that we're staying topical and current and popular with the kids these days?
Good examples of that, at least here in the U.S., the first one being, like, you look at the CSI series, primarily like the first one or two, where the theme songs are so ingrained in that show now, like you can't hear them on the radio without thinking that somebody's watching CSI somewhere. It fits the theme of the show. It fits the feel of it. So that is a good use of popular music, granted a bit dated, but still, it's that works. Whereas on the other side of the coin, you have the scenes from, say, like Buffy, where it's like, hey, we're going to the club, and insert music act to get some screen time.
Yeah, and none of those artists were ever really heard from again, whoever was playing there. Take another example, though. I mean, I remember examples of things like, you know, I want to take back another one of these kind of, you know, crappy U.S. shows, Melrose Place, or things like that, or the 90210s of that era, which were ones where there would be artists that would suddenly appear because they'd suddenly decided, hey, gang, let's all get in the car and go to a show. And
yeah,
they just happened to be appearing. So you wonder how much of it is kind of lip service and how much of it is they're trying to propel one career or the other, you know, or one medium or the other,
right,
by crossing the two streams. I will say this, you know, based on everything that we've sort of been pulling together for tonight, the Who franchise has, up until very, very recently, has not utilized the actual guest appearance,
right,
of the artist. With the one, I mean, I'll say Kylie Minogue out there, but she didn't sing or perform in any way.
She was a guest star.
Her acting phase, yeah. Right. And as far as, you know, as far as using pop culture figures, that who's been doing that since the get-go? You've been you know, popular actors and specifically comedians making a lot of appearances going back, you know, the full 50-year run. So music industry is not uncharted waters. It just, you didn't happen to have the doctor suddenly, you know, vorping his way, you know, into the back of Madison Square Garden or something like that during a show, and the camera pans over and there's, you know, the Who.
Right.
That meta.
Yeah.
So,
you know, the thing that I've always enjoyed is the moments where, like, you know, in the Ninth Doctor run, what was it, the second episode, the End of the World, where they're playing Tainted Love. You know, it's like, that was one of those moments where it's like, you know, it doesn't stick out in my mind as, like, you know, a high point of the show or anything like that. But it's like somebody mentions it, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot that was in there, because it actually kind of fit. You know, it was one of those, like, it was odd. You know, I don't know. It didn't fit the general feel of the show, I guess. But at the same time, it did kind of fit. So it's one of those things that I enjoy hearing those songs in there if they're done kind of like that. You know, the one that stands out the most in my mind is, you know, the Master on the Bridge of the Valiant when he comes in. Because that was a whole scene, and it was played up to be completely over the top, and it's stuck in your memory, even if you can't see it on Netflix now. But,
well, he was pantomiming the full lyric rundown on it. It wasn't just background music. He was, and it wasn't, he wasn't just dancing to it. He was mouthing out, he was lip syncing the lyrics.
Yeah.
As he kind of strolled around the control room there, you know, throwing his coffee around and such. But I mean, it was intrinsically involved. And kind of in keeping with that, you think about the whole, and it was pervasive through the episode. We're kind of sticking with Modern Who here, but the whole ELO reference all through Love and Monsters.
Right, yes.
I mean, that practically, Mr. Blue Sky was like the score for the entire damn episode. You know, they started out, the whole gathering of them got together because they were an ELO fan club or whatever, you know, kind of thing. So it bookends the entire episode in that regard. In smaller aspects, I mean, if we want to, we'll start with the present, we'll work our way to the past, because who goes by chronological order? As I mentioned earlier, the whole idea of having actual musical guest appearances, Fox's is one of the only ones that really stands out as far as having a moment where you've got a pop artist performing on screen within the scene, a la Buffy kind of thing.
Yeah.
But even that, it's not her original material. Checking on that. She's doing a Queen cover. So, but it's kind of her kind of smoky lounge kind of take on it. That sets a precedent for what can be done down the road. I mean, and I know with the news about One Direction, do they still have a career?
I don't know. I don't follow them. I don't know. Apparently one of them left and maybe he's back. I don't know.
It's really hard to track boy bands on either side of the Atlantic. But as far as that goes, I mean, as far as still being a recognizable name, an entity, with something like that, that's where I'd step in and start to say, okay, now I'm not really sure if this is something that would have been a natural insertion.
Mm-hmm.
or if one or the other side of this arrangement is doing so strictly for personal benefit. And I would I don't know who on either side of that coin, whether it's the Doctor Who franchise as of today or whatever semblance of mainstream popularity that One Direction still has. I say this as if their careers were over. I honestly don't know. I actually, and I'm being straight up honest with you. I could not give you three notes out of any song. I don't know anything that they do.
Yeah.
Not a damn thing. But
sorry, we're not okay. The target audience. You know,
I am not.
Middle-aged white guys. You know, imagine that. It's just
look at me. But it does mean, you know, that the door is open as a result of like the Fox's appearance and things like that. The door is open to be able to have something like, you know, which leaves the middle-aged white guy and me thinking, God damn it, David Bowie needs to just do a walk-on moment where he just strolls through, offers somebody a glass of champagne, walks off humming to himself. That to me is a musical appearance. That's all I need. But just the same. So the door is open artists.
And I kind of feel like we might be giving them the short end of the stick on this one, because it very well could be that, you know, one or multiple members of the group are fans of the show, at least enough to be like, hey, you know what? If we ever get a chance to be on there, we'd love to do it. You know, so it could be something as simple as that, is like, you know what? This is a show that I've watched since I was a kid. I want to be on, you know, sure, I'll do it. Or, you know, it's, or a request has been put forth or something. I don't know. Yeah. So that's a very real possibility. So it might not be someone trying to cash in on the other one, but who knows?
Right, and precisely, just like, as I mentioned, there's a number of people from the comedic industry, whether it's film, television, stand-up, or things like that in the UK, that clamor to say, you know, given the opportunity, I'd love to be able to, you know, to come on. Or Rufus Hound, you know, in his upcoming appearance in Series 9, was based because, you know, if you ask him about it, he begged, pleaded, stole, kidnapped, you know, did whatever he had to be able to secure his position in the show. But it's really no different. Because it's them wanting to be involved in an entity. I'm not going to, you know, refer to it as a franchise at this point, because it's really not. I don't think it's coming from a place of business necessarily. Mm-hmm. Sure, it may be something that helps kind of, you know, put the spurs to a career, you know, by having you referenced. It's just cross referencing at that point.
Yeah.
In other industries, but it can be done simply because of love of the content. You know, how many guests from within the acting community have said, oh, it's been a dream of mine to be on Doctor Who for 20, 30, 40 years, and now I finally get to do that, even if it's just a very minor role. You know, the line extends beyond the door. There's nothing saying that it has to be strictly from the acting community.
Yeah.
So I don't really have a problem with it until it becomes something like, until it intrudes on the story.
Right. Until it's something like Gunslingers.
You see, you keep bringing that up. We have yet to really take that episode apart.
That's true. It's going to come, though. There's going to come a time.
Yeah, and I'm going to defend it to the hilt, because that was just... You talk about romps. Mm. When you're getting to the point where you're starting to put together hokey Western saloon songs to justify, you know, it's a singer be shot. Mm-hmm. I'm going to defend that. So, But I mean, as far as things, let's get the opportunity now to kind of step back a little bit to some of the references up to this point before Fox's and some of the actual on-screen appearances of music artists performing on the program. Mm-hmm. You would have the utilization of pop tunes, whether they were current to the year or whether it was just really appropriate for the usage at the point of original broadcast.
Yeah.
I mean, this goes way, way back, you know. We referenced it at the intro. So where do we really kick off with this?
Well, I mean, the first one that we really come across is, you know, the Beatles playing Ticket to Ride in the, what was it, the Chase in the first Doctor era.
Yeah, and this is something where it was a matter of at the point where they were pulled from, I guess, the clip that was seen on a screen, you know, as the Doctor's looking through on his vid screen, and I think Ian does something to kind of mess up the change the station effectively or something of that sort, and the Doctor makes a comment to that effect. you've got this clip from the Beatles playing on Top of the Pops from 65, equally, you know, probably the same viewership at the time that Doctor Who probably had at that point. But so, and that's obviously, think about that, the same year Ticket to Ride obviously being from the Help album, which had its cinematic release to go along with it. So it was inescapable.
Yeah.
So the crossing of the two was really just a matter of two strong entities in support of one another in that regard. And I think there were actually instances, or there was some premise where the Beatles were supposed to appear. There were plans for a story within the works where within one of the episodes there was going to be a crossing of the paths.
Right.
Didn't actually end up making it to point of production for a number of reasons, if I remember correctly. And if I track down the original backstory on it, because I came across it quite some time back, I'll put it in the comments on site here. But the Beatles, as far as their music, ended up making numerous appearances through, and I'm going to put a little asterisk up in the corner here, so bing, there it is up there, in the original broadcast representations of a lot of the classic Who era, because anything at this point that you grab off DVD, because of continued licensing arrangements, can no longer continue to utilize the songs. So, I mean, the most memorable, I mean, you're going all the way up to Seventh Doctor, Remembrance of the Daleks. The only way you can actually get it is if you get, there's a box set out there that's known as the Davros box set.
Okay.
That has, I'm not sure how this ended up happening, but for some reason, that box set, you have, you can hear the Beatles' Taste of Honey and Do You Want to Know a Secret playing as part of the backing tracks, whereas on every other recording that you're going to get now has been replaced with studio musicians and unrecognizable tracks.
Right. And see, all right, so the way that I understand this the most is that when a TV show wants to use, or a TV show or a movie or whatever wants to use a song, then they have to pay a license fee, right? That's how the musicians get paid.
Sure.
So they have the option to say, okay, here, we're going to pay you X number of dollars for, you know, for use of this song throughout the end of time. You know, we get the right to use it, and we can, you know, continually produce this thing. Or they can say, okay, we'll give you a fraction of this money, and we can use it up until X date.
Correct.
Now, most of the time, that's not a problem, because when you, yeah, you go and see the movie in the theater, it's still within that time frame. When they put the DVD out, it's still within that time frame. But then, you know, a year, 2 years after that or whatever, then it's, you know, it's not there anymore, which you've already bought the DVD, so it doesn't matter. It's already been purchased and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that we're starting to see now with the Netflix model and stuff is songs that hit that expiration date where they say you can't use the song anymore, because with the Netflix subscription model, you're purchasing it again every month. Mm-hmm. So you've got it through March, and then April comes, and that scene is now missing entirely because they don't have the right to put that in their stuff anymore.
Right. Or, as a result, has been the case in a fraction of those instances, when you see that a season of a program or something of that sort are gone off of Netflix or Amazon Prime, you know, Instant Watch, what have you. It's because it wasn't always a pricing negotiation between the distribution medium and the production houses. It was legal issues over some of that creative content.
Yeah.
So a smaller fraction. It usually comes down to the money, but in a few cases, it actually is a result of them missing a deadline in trying to get renewal rights on intellectual property for musicians. Which is really just funny when you think about it, because of the fact that when you've got models like Spotify and Pandora out there that I know from musicians that I've been in contact with that have material out there, and the pittance that they receive for the music that gets distributed. You know, I've got I would consider him a friend of ours who has about 3 or 4 albums worth of material that gets rotated on Pandora, and he says, you know, I could probably pay for gas for a month on everything that I've received. So that is really just a matter of getting your name recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And with things like the inclusion in the television episodes, especially if you get mid-1970s or so, you weren't really thinking syndication.
Right.
So if that was the case, then from the BBC standpoint, take the smaller check.
Right, because you're going to air it, and then you're done, and you're not out a crap ton of money for music you're never going to have to use again.
Precisely. Or in the cases where they realized that they may end up having to replace it later, they didn't really think too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, which has been the case with a lot of the stuff, you know, pre-Sixth Doctor or so, or in this case, Seventh Doctor, yeah, because they ended up replacing a lot of the tunes that you would hear in, you know, dance hall scenes and things like that with McCoy that have been replaced with sort of what we would now consider Creative Commons kind of material.
Yeah. All right, so one thing that I want to bring up, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but the kind of music that gets put in as background music that you don't pay attention to. Because, all right, when I first brought this subject up, what were the first couple instances that you thought of?
Outside of the Modern Who references?
Well, or just any time that, you know, the music, the popular music has really stood out to you and you remember this is a moment where it got used.
Well, as we referenced, Tainted Love and End of the World
mm-hmm.
was pretty much a given because that was, for me, I mean, that was material. I would, being a kid of the 80s, you know, I hear Soft Cell. And, yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, God. Come on. And they also use Britney Spears,
right?
That Toxic song in there, which was funny, but applicable for the time. That was relevant yeah. to the moment, 2005, present day, couldn't be more utilizable content.
Right.
The ELO in Love and Monsters was something that, you know, because it was so over
so
the top,
in your face, and yeah.
Yeah. Dancing around to it and such, that totally got mm-hmm. that absolutely fine. So those were two that stood out particularly. If I were thinking anything farther back, there it really got a lot fuzzier because so much of the material by the time I got introduced to it, even going up into Sixth, Seventh Doctor, had been, it was already in syndication, in which case a lot of the material had already been replaced by unrecognizable content.
Yeah.
Well, unmemorable, I should say.
Okay, well, let's just look at New Who then, because I was kind of in the same boat. I thought of, you know, obviously Foxes showing up, you know, the Scissor Sisters with the Master.
Yep.
You know, there were just a couple of those moments. Yeah, Merry Christmas, Everybody by Slade during the Christmas
sure.
special. Yeah, a couple moments where it's like, okay, yes, they were popular music here, but I mean, we're talking. All right, so we talked about Soft Cell, Britney Spears, David Bowie was in Aliens of London, Rick mm-hmm. Astley. The Streets yeah. were in Father's Day. You know, then we've got, let's see, Gary Glitter, Ian Dury and the Blockheads in the 10th Doctor's era,
mm-hmm.
Tight Fit, Elton John, Il Divo. You know, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I did not, like, as I'm looking over the list, I'm like, yes, okay, I remember that now. You know, Adele playing in the cafe in The Impossible Astronaut.
Yeah. You have to be really careful to catch these things. Like, yeah. like, all right, take, you know, you're starting into the 11th Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's scenes in things like, take The Impossible Astronaut,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you take that moment. So that diner sequence lasts minute and a half,
something like that,
tops. Yeah. And you've got those crappy little coin-op jukeboxes. That's a very stateside kind of thing, sorry folks in the UK. but yeah, so imagine sitting there and being forced that for the cost of a quarter, you're being forced to listen to whatever the guy two tables down from you wants to listen to, because everybody has access to the same record player
yeah.
in the back. So there's a jukebox sitting in the back. I love old technology. and you could, the only thing you could do, and the I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here, but screw it. So you go into the diner, it's 3 a.m., you're probably still drunk, and you sit down and you have a fistful of quarters, and you pop them in because you want to hear some song that you think you recognize the title through your blurred vision. And because you've put a quarter in, the machine starts to play, but it doesn't necessarily play your selection right away because this is pre-touchscreen,
right.
get what you want when you want it. It just says, oh, here's a table that wants to listen to music. So it starts playing whatever the currently playing record is in the back, which is whatever that guy three tables down has selected, that you're going to have to listen through everything he's already paid for before your song comes up. So that's the backdrop where you've got Rolling in the Deep, which was probably for its year the most recognizable pop R&B song. It was inescapable.
Yeah.
By good right.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you go forward to two episodes?
Mm-hmm.
No, three episodes to The Rebel Flesh.
Three? Okay, right. I lose track, but somewhere thereabouts.
Okay. Which is all taking place. It's kind of off-world. It's very disconnected. It's disjointed. The plot line is bizarre because you're dealing with the whole, you know, the sort of the morphed figures and such. So you're not really paying a whole lot of attention to the score. But in that episode alone, you've got not only Dusty Springfield, it's kind of a recognizable entity back from that day, but Muse, supermassive black hole.
Yes.
Which, personally, I'm a Muse fan.
Oh, me too.
And of course, if you got something where you've got that nice little ha-ha, tongue-in-cheek reference to a black hole within a Doctor Who episode, I mean, that's a great little meta kick-in. Mm-hmm. But it's only being heard for about 30 seconds.
Yeah,
it's in brief. In a quick TARDIS console room scene, and then we're off to the races.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when we talk about the utilization of pop music within the episodes, a lot of times it has been relegated to incidentals.
Right. But see, that's going back to my point, though. Like, when you bring up the topic, people have those distinct moments that they can remember because it's in your face, because that's something that stood out to you. But this is something that's been going on for a very long time and happens way more often than we realize. Because, like you said, it is just background. It's incidental. It's not a big thing. So when we get to the present day, do you remember when they announced that Foxes was going to be on Doctor Who? They were going to have a musical act on Doctor Who. And you could hear the collective nerd universe just kind of,
Yeah.
I mean, there was so much bitching about it because it's like, you know, this isn't what Doctor Who does. And then the episode comes out and it's like, wow, that fit brilliantly. You know, the song that they chose, the style they decided to do it in, and the way that they portrayed it on screen, just, I mean, it enhanced the flavor of the episode so much that I'm like, I look back on it and I'm like, wow, I kind of feel bad for being a dick about that now.
And I know you were talking about ones that stood out, and I actually had forgotten about this until I got a chance to go back and look over a lot of the rundowns. Take the Angels, Take Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Because we knew, this should be kind of interesting from us here on the stateside. Because now, how often do we actually get something that's actually, you know, set other than, you know, down at Lake Silencio or that sort of thing that's happening here in the States? But Manhattan, for crying out loud, they're going to be in Central Park. I'm going to see, you know, all these landmarks. But as they're doing the montage, as we're running through and saying, okay, there's Central Park, there's Fifth Avenue, there's the Met, there's da-da-da-da-da. We're hearing Sting, Englishman in New York.
Yeah.
Until we finally end up closing in on Matt Smith sitting there on the rock with Amy and Rory and reading their books and having a chit-chat, which was absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
So at that point, it goes from being incidental to being something that helps establish scene or mood. So those are definitely ones that stand out.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's kind of the thing, though, that I'm noticing is that, you know, a lot of this stuff, when we get the news up front, we automatically, for some reason, go to the worst-case scenario. Like, oh, One Direction's going to be on the show. It's just, it's going to be ruined. This is going to be horrible. I'm going to hate this episode. And it's, you know, it's the knee-jerk reaction, and I don't know why that is, because looking back on this, like, I can't find a single point where the music didn't at least, you know, at least wasn't entertaining in the moment.
So we're on the point as far as the preconceived notions or the pre-hate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, I have to say, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I've decided that I want to start getting, you know, a shameless plug that this other cast that I'm going to be trying to get off the ground shortly has to do in large part with people that have a lot of preconceptions and prejudgments about material before they've been given the opportunity to see it through. And this is a great distillation of that sort of mentality, because whether it is a musical artist who is establishing an acting career to go along with, a la Kylie Minogue or something of that sort, or whether it is someone who is coming on simply because they want to walk on role because they are a fan of the program and they're not really looking to necessarily contribute musical performance, but they just want to be a part of the spectacle and the legacy that is the show, or whatever the case may be. You know, when they make these announcements, they're doing so because they know that there's going to be a large portion of the consuming public that's going to get excited about it, which is one of the reasons why they made the decision in the first place. And maybe it's just easier to push things down than it is to lift them up. You know, if you want to take that strange metaphor. But I think with examples like foxes or with the oncoming storm that is One Direction. You like that? Ring the bell. It's just, you know, it's not going to, even if it's not something that you personally appreciate, it is not going to drag the show down to a flaming wreck. It's just going to be something that to you personally is not that much of an appeal, but to the other 97% of the viewing public that is not, a diehard pre-hater or something like that, it's going to do just fine. Either it's going to really please them because, hey, these are two things that I love. It's like Reese's Cups here. I got exactly. Peanut butter and chocolate. Or it's just going to be people that said, you know, I really didn't notice. I don't know who One Direction is. So these you know, mop-headed kids came strolling by wearing extremely expensive fashion, and they were out on the scene 2 minutes later, and I didn't catch it.
Yeah.
So I don't see the problem.
I mean, until I see an episode of Doctor Who where everything stops so that you can, you know, focus on the band on the stage, a la 50s surf movies kind of thing. I've decided I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to crap on anything until I've seen it, because that's, like I was saying, there, nothing has ever detracted from the show for me music wise. It's never been anything that's taken me out of it and said, no, this is stupid, you know. So,
except for some of the synthesizers in the mid-80s or something. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln.
Yeah, but so I don't know. I'm really enjoying, now that I'm going back through, because I've always enjoyed going back and listening to the stuff that Murray Gold has done with the new series. But, you know, I never paid attention to the pop music that was in there. So I'm going back now and looking through these. I'm like, man, I need to watch some of these episodes again with this in mind and see how they fit in. Because, like I said, a lot of them didn't stand out to me. And I want to see just how artfully they were put in there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the more recent ones, and this was funny because it was actually one of the few instances where when watching the episode the first time through, I start to hear a riff and I think, oh, this scene would be perfect for blah, blah, blah song. Mm-hmm. You take Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, where you've got, you know, when you see the salvage ship coming through and the brothers are coming in and they're getting ready to do their hack job, and you've got the cult cranking out Fire Woman. I mean, granted, great selection for the song. What I personally, in my head, I was hearing something like AC/DC. The same sort of vibe,
right?
You know, I mean, you're jumping a decade or two, but it had that kind of, this scene, these guys are just out there to hack and slash, take apart, you know, salvage and scourge. They need, you know, some sort of a heavy guitar riff, kind of crunchy grit. And that was an excellent selection. And I knew exactly what the song was. I mean, I know the song inherently well, but it fit perfectly well. Backtrack a little bit to something like the Ultravox references in Cold War.
I was about to bring that up.
And as the professor's walking around and he keeps, you know, wondering whether or not someone has met them, is the band still together and that sort of thing. I mean, that's or having to sing through Hungry Like the Wolf and that kind of thing as Clara does. That's really, at that point, anybody now who's saying, oh, you can't involve pop music in the show, it's just taken away. It has nothing to do with anything that, you know, it's timeless, so it shouldn't have anything to do with songs that are going on right now. Well, neither of those songs had anything to do with 2013, 2014.
Right.
I mean, you're going back to the 80s or earlier at that point, so what, if anything, that just contributes to the timelessness or the anachronism. Somebody help me with these words.
No, but say,
I'm going to say asynchronous, but that's not right. It has to do with being anachronistic. Anachronistic! That's the goddamn word I needed.
All right.
Thank you, Tom Baker Bobblehead Doll.
See, that's an interesting take, though, because when I think of that, like, I don't necessarily take it as, you know, as talking about the time of the episode or anything like that. I mean, it was, you know, related to the time that the episode was supposed to take place. But for me, though, having that music in there was far more about establishing who the character was than anything else. Right. So I felt like that had a great place in that, because simply having him listening to Ultravox on his little Walkman just made that character for me. And I understood
that Walkman who was
I understood who he was.
Stolen by the Star-Lord. That was the Star-Lord's water. Just checking.
Oh, that's why. Okay, so the Doctor had hit it with his screwdriver, so that's why it didn't degrade after, you know, 30 years in space. Okay, got it.
Precisely. Best cassette tape ever.
All right, but all right. So we did have a little bit of feedback on this topic. We put the question out there, you know, to find out what you thought about the music in Doctor Who and stuff. So, Michael Ferguson, who runs a Companions of the Doctor, said, "For me, the Beatles / classic music gag never gets old. Not to mention having anticipated McCartney actually becoming a classical composer." Right. And the Ninth Doctor jamming to Soft Cell's Tainted Love is also fun to watch. So, yeah, we didn't even talk about that when, you know, the Beatles popped up and you had, who was it, Vicky, who, you know, is from the 25th century and, you know, talks about the Beatles as classical music.
Right, which was fine. I'm sure Sir Paul was pleased to hear that was coming along.
Changed the whole course of his adulthood after that. It was, you know, he knew where he was going at that point.
Life imitates art. Yeah, so, I mean, absolutely great observation. I mean, these are ones where, when it's done right, it's really done there, not necessarily to drive the story, but to support it and embellish it and make it more of a full experience. Exactly. Because as we've said so many times with what Murray Gold composes, you're not always even aware of what you're listening to, you know, because it becomes part of the overall audiovisual experience. And they become synonymous with one another. And it's something that I'm really looking forward to, that a lot of people out in the UK are experiencing right now. We're going to have it later this year with the symphonic experience that's coming through. That's something where it's now slightly flipped. Now you've got the full orchestration and the display screen to the back. So your sensory input has been slightly tilted to be more auditory first, but even in that distribution, they recognize the importance of saying this is a mutual experience for the audience in connecting their memories of this story. You know, when you think through the story, you may even be remembering as you're chatting with somebody and talking about, wasn't that a great scene? And the, you know, good man goes to war and blah, 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 blah. And in the back of your mind, somewhere on the subconscious level, you're hearing the score or the dramatic strains of I Am the Doctor scrolling up. You know, it's inescapable.
Yeah.
And it's necessary because you can find, go out, it's very easy to find some of the most memorable movie moments from cinematic history of any genre. And there are actually a couple of channels out there on YouTube that will present the same scene to you with the score removed. And it feels so thin.
Oh, yeah.
So, and that's just orchestration. Now you take something that then marries that moment to recognizable pop content, whether it's present day relevant or something that has become part of, you know, the landscape of popular music over the course of however many decades you want to track it back. And it still has that same thing. If it's used properly, which I think in a lot of these instances we're seeing exactly that, it's something that is used to punctuate, accentuate, or finish coloring in the emotion of that particular scene. The Englishman in New York, to just put you in that mindset of, you know, isn't this unusual? Look at me, I'm out of place, I'm out of time, but I'm loving it because it's such a spectacle here in this big city. That's exactly what they wanted to convey. That's what you got out of 8 bars of the entire song that actually end up playing.
Yeah, so it's definitely very important. And so then the next bit of feedback that we got, we put the question out there on Twitter as well, saying, you know, should the idea of musical guest appearances continue on Doctor Who? And none other than Paul Cornell actually supported the idea, saying that this is something that needs to continue. So
yeah, it is definitely. I think he tends to look at the program long view.
Yeah,
obviously, and he's also very attached to the involvement of music within his other artistic productions. I mean, you look at his forthcoming This Damn Band comic series that'll be out in Dark Horse in a couple of months, and that's all about what looks remarkably like The Who about a band that has sold their souls. Literally has sold their souls for their career, and it kind of follows them through that demise, question mark. But that's, you know, that's, again, it kind of goes along with the fact that it is a medium that requires a full experience. And if you solely rely on, there's very few programs I can think about there that rely solely on their own original score and orchestration. Once they run for a while, there's, you know, it not necessarily having Coldplay playing behind every song or what have you, but every once in a while you'll have a scene where, you know, someone says, you know what, we could go ahead and we could go to the studio and we could record something to put some emotion behind this, but this scene right now is screaming this artist,
yeah,
this song, so let's pursue it, see if we can get the rights to it so we can use it. And just, you know, round out the emotion that we're trying to convey. Mm. And it's never going to change. And I don't think it should. I have to agree with Mr. Cornett. I don't think it's, you know, even the whole idea of the appearances by the artists, as it's, you know, based on their very short track record at this point, it's not obtrusive.
Yeah.
So I don't mind in the least.
Yeah, and I don't think that it will become that point. I mean, that nobody's going to try and run the show into the ground just for the sake of cramming a musical artist in there. If they're going to bring them on, I feel like they're going to do it properly, and it's going to be in the same kind of vein that we saw with Foxes. So, yeah, I think we're all fully in support of that. So,
mm-hmm. I think, and I hate to kind of jump genres here, but I think about for just the utilization of pop material as it's being performed, one of the things, another show that I was very fond of, continue to be fond of, American Horror Story. I know, Jay, you're not a particular watcher of the show, mm-hmm. But in this past season, they decided that one of their... I'll call it a gimmick, for lack of a better word. One of the recurring elements that they would have to the show, because it was taking place in a circus freak show, mm-hmm. kind of setup, was that they would have the sort of out of time, anachronistic
there you
utilization
go.
of pop tunes, including David Bowie, Nirvana, and so forth, being performed by the cast members as part of their freak show, you know, that they were performing on stage. In the early 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting David Bowie's Life on Mars or Nirvana's Come As You Are being performed on a stage in 1960s. I can't even remember at this point. But somehow it worked because it was the right piece done in the right way. And they weren't just performing the song straight up. They were doing sort of interpretations of them, similarly to what Foxes did with the Queen tune. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just a straight cover.
Right.
That in and of itself says, okay, there is some, it's not only creative license, there is a specific artistic message being conveyed by doing it this way.
Right.
So as it has that careful control, I don't think they're going to let it get out of hand.
Yeah. You know, and you brought that up, and I can't help but think when a, you know, one of the first times I remember pop music actually like standing out to me and making like improving the product was in Pixar's Cars, because Pixar up to that point hadn't done any kind of music aside from like, you know, a score really.
Yeah.
And then there's a moment where they're going driving through the countryside and it starts playing Life as a Highway. And it was absolutely perfect. And I remember it coming on, and it was a jarring thing for me because I knew Pixar movies. I know Pixar. I know what they do. And so for them to put a pop music in there, I was kind of like, oh, wow, this actually fits. This sounds good. And then you take the other side of that coin. And if you think back to A Knight's Tale with Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
Where I
mean, like David Bowie's Fame and, yeah. and songs like
but,
that. Yeah.
But I enjoy that movie. Don't get me wrong. It's a guilty pleasure. I really do enjoy that movie. Mm-hmm. But the music really does seem like, hey, you know what? We need music. Let's cram this in here. It doesn't fit, but let's do it anyway.
I'll one-up you on that. Because I think what was attempting to be done, and we're just straying way off here, but the hell with it, because it's a short cast and you can enjoy it. So the... that premise, I think, was pulled almost wholeheartedly from the Red Curtain trilogy and what Baz Luhrmann was doing with movies like Moulin Rouge,
mm-hmm.
because that was the utilization of pop songs that were completely reworked and reinterpreted by the artists. So you had actually Ewan McGregor and so forth actually performing the songs throughout, and they were way out of time, way out of position. But because they were all about the emotion being conveyed, and you've got a tango version of the Police, you know, doing Roxanne, you know, was just incredible. And you forget very quickly that, wait a second, this doesn't fit, but it fits. And I think we're going to end up with more of that, because that has that and a few other examples outside of that genre have made it clear that as far as musical composition goes, if you've got something that casts a tone or it has a lyrical content that if you just do a little bit of adjustment and sort of view it through, you know, like Foxes takes that very kind of smoky, sultry jazz cover to something that was more of a rock opera, piano-based, upbeat kind of driving number in Don't Stop Me Now, just says that there is something to that material that suits, and we have the time, the attention, the resources, and the talent to do exactly what we want.
Yeah.
So go ahead, bring on One Direction. I can't wait to see. We don't even know whether they're actually going to be performing.
Yeah.
So be that as it may, do whatever you want. Rock it out.
All right. Well, if you have thoughts on this, do us a favor. And while we try and, you know, hike back to the rails, because it's a long walk from here, go over to GallifreyPublicRadio.com/138 and leave your thoughts on this topic in the show notes. I'm actually going to put the list of music that has been used on Doctor Who in the show notes, so you can see all of the music that we've been talking about, and, you know, remind yourself, oh yeah, I forgot that was in there. That was great. Mm-hmm. So, you know, leave your thoughts on the comments there, because we want to hear what you have to think about it. So, how about we go ahead and take it into the news?
I like news.
All right, so the first bit of news that we've got, we'll start with the big one. If you are going to San Diego Comic-Con, rejoice, because Doctor Who is back.
Yes, and back big.
Yeah, Peter.
It's a huge panel.
Peter Capaldi, Jenna Coleman, Michelle Gomez, Stephen Moffat, Brian Minchin. So I mean, this
the Minch.
Yes,
my man, the unsung hero.
So I mean, taking a break from San Diego Comic Con and then coming back in a big way. So I'm kind of upset that I'm not going now, because it might be worth the entire trip just to see this panel, because this is huge.
Well, could there be any more difficult stateside con to get badges to? It is infamous for the complexity of the attendance process and grandfathering in lotteries and all sorts of crazy stuff. It's nerds, straight up. And, you know, we will have some friends that are attending, and we're going to try and beg, borrow, steal, bribe, kidnap, I don't care, whatever's necessary, to have a voice on the inside. But if we have listeners attending as well, drop us a line. We might make it worth your time.
Please do. Yeah, because I can't wait to hear what comes out of this, because this is actually going to be, they'll be done with filming at this point. And it'll all just be, you know, post-production kind of stuff, waiting for Series 9 to come out.
Right.
So I know that they will have their practiced lines of, you know, it's like, well, you're just going to have to wait a couple weeks and see what happens with Missy showing back up. And
when they've got the Grand Moff right there with them, they're just going to, at any point, if it's questions about are you going to or will we see, they're just going to look to him and he's going to...
It's going to be a cracker of an episode.
Absolute crack. But yeah, and then everyone will turn to Minchin, and he'll just say, I unfortunately have wonderful things to say, but I can't because this man is sitting next to me.
But, you know, speaking of Stephen Moffat, he actually came out in an interview with the Doctor Who magazine recently and talked about the Day of the Doctor, and he admits that he is still haunted by guilt over reversing the outcome of the Time War.
Yep. So... fans rejoice if you were screaming about repercussions of the alteration of what was expected to be canon. Mm-hmm. 'Cause at this point, his choice of words, you know, as he says that, that, you know, he understands that this was a monetary and a broadcast success that would end up playing out through Day of the Doctor.
Right.
But the guilt over his inversion of the potential outcome and the fact that Gallifrey still stands in some fashion is something that riddles him with guilt. Considers himself haunted by the guilt, which is a fascinating choice of words by a man who chooses his words very carefully.
Yeah.
So he quotes as saying, you know, I know that some of you, including friends of mine, were upset that we reversed the outcome of the Time War. And my defense, however feeble, now look at this. I've never heard him so so self-effacing. This is amazing. My defense, however feeble, is that given the chance, the Doctor would do exactly that. And it was his birthday, so how could I deny him that chance? What could define him more? This man who always finds another way. And there he is, at every moment of his life, proving to himself literally that there is always a better path. Mm-hmm. So, now granted, he, Moffat, still has the opportunity of crafting this going forward any way he chooses.
Right.
And kicking the can down the road to whoever wants to take the mantle from him in a couple of years' time. But I don't know. What does this say to you about the fact that he's willing to admit to this?
Honestly, it makes me wonder what plan he had. Because if he had it set out and said, okay, no, I'm going to bring the Time Lords back. We're going to do this. We're, you know, step A, B through N, you know, this is how it's going to play out, then people complaining about it wouldn't have impacted him. He'd have been like, no, just wait. You're going to see, it's going to be awesome. But because he feels guilty about it, because he's talking like this, it makes me think, no, I just flipped it because what else are you going to do for the 50th? And I don't know what to do with it now.
Well, I'm always going to go back around to the point where I don't think there is anything when he takes the program, when he takes the story, when he takes the canon, mm-hmm. three steps forward as far as what gets presented to the public. I think in all instances, he has already drafted in his mind or potentially on paper somewhere five steps forward. So I don't think he's freewheeling by yeah. any regard, but he is not the first writer of any medium to say, to admit, yeah, you know, in retrospect, I might have, you know, carried this character further, embellished this arc mm-hmm. a little farther, or what have you. At this point, though, he's dealing with something that has had so many cooks in the kitchen
yeah.
that, you know, for him to make, I'm going to continue with this analogy, to keep the dish fresh, you have to put some, you know, some X factors in there somewhere. And granted, this is something that could potentially be very problematic for future writing because of, as we've talked about, what's the impact of bringing back Gallifrey? In fact, that's something, you know, we're not done talking about. I see Reddit discussions that go on for days that that have to do with everyone chiming in about the potential repercussions, whether it ever gets fully realized or not. But as I suggested, this may be something where he just says, I know my time here is finite and the show has to continue to evolve. So in order for it to do that without some major, major character changes, which don't always have the kind of upheaval, long-term upheaval, because you can bring characters in and bring them out and the show continues to kind of follow the same general path. But something like this is not just a chapter, this is a volume in and of itself. So by opening that door back up and then him walking away says, okay, I wanted to open a can of worms and hand it to someone else to do something really creative with. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, you've seen three steps, I've written five.
Right.
His steps four and five are make things a little messier, hand it off.
Yeah.
Because that forces originality and forces evolution.
Yeah. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. I want to believe that he does have a solid plan, or at least a decent outline for how this is supposed to play out in his mind. Whether or not that's what we wind up getting and what we wind up seeing, I don't know, but I want to believe the best in him, and I don't know. I think it's going to be fun no matter what, just seeing how it all plays out.
Anyone who wants to tweet us a photo of the shiny quarter that they are going to bet against me, I will get this quarter out of my pocket right now, and I will tweet this before the night is out. This will be the quarter that I'll be putting up against, along with all of its brethren and sisterin, that get put against any other quarters presented, that we will see another High Council collar. Oh, gigantic collar before Series 9 is out. We may not have an answer to the entire status of Gallifrey, but we are not done seeing a Time Lord in a position of power before this series is out. I'm gonna just do that. It may just be wishful thinking on my part, but it's really positive wishful thinking on my part. So I will tweet that quarter.
All right. And then the
at Gallifrey Radio.
The last bit, well, not really news, but the last thing we wanted to bring up here is Long Island Who coming up in November. If you have not bought your registration yet, by the time you listen to this, it is already too late to get the reduced price. Let me try that again so I don't confuse people. If you haven't already gotten your registration for this con, you can no longer get your reduced price tickets. That ends through May 1st. So as we're recording this, you've got about an hour and 45 minutes. So you're not going to get it if you're listening to this.
I'm going to tweet that before I tweet that. I'll retweet. They just put a warning out a couple hours ago that literally said, last few hours, TikTok goes a clock.
But the good news is that if you're listening to this and you want to get one, and it's, you know, obviously too late, through August 31st, you can still get a 3-day pass for $85 for an adult or $69 for a child. So that's
best $85 you could possibly spend.
I mean, the price is only going up $10, so it's not like a huge, you know, you've lost out completely, but
You just paid for two drinks at the bar. I'm just saying.
And then once September 1st hits, the price will go up to the full $95 and stay that way through, you know, sellout or the convention, whichever comes first. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting because they've sold out both previous years, but they have moved to a new location this year. So,
we'll see. I don't think that's going to buy anybody too much wiggle room because as word has continued, you're going only into the third year of this convention. It's growing exponentially. So, and not only just growing in terms of attendance, but growing in terms of recognition and support from the talent that really wants to come out and be involved with it. I mean, we had how many doctors present last year? Okay. How many companions, writers, producers, directors, nearly the entire Big Finish production staff. I mean, it was massive.
Yeah.
In year two. So please. And we're all going to be there.
Yeah.
And
I mean, already they've got, you know, Katie Manning, Carol Ann Ford, Gemma Redgrave, you know, Nick Briggs, Fraser Hines. I mean, the guest list is already starting to become a major thing. And they haven't even announced like the headliners yet. So
these are headliners. God. Jim Redgrave.
Well,
Briggs, well, Fraser Hines. Oh my God.
I know.
And I'm so glad to see that Carol Ann Ford is really starting to do a lot of the con circuits again. Because she's absolutely fascinating to listen to. And especially I really want to find out. In fact, I might drop a couple of questions into to the folks there for the planning committees to see whether they are going to pull together a Big Finish panel that has a lot of the talent that has been involved with productions, because obviously Carol Ann Ford reprising her Susan Foreman role in the Eighth Doctor adventures. So I want to know. Yeah, you know, I'd love to be able to have some of the anecdotes from their in-studio discussions as well. So
yeah, so definitely go and get your registration as soon as you possibly can, because this is going to be a great convention and I cannot wait for it. It's looking great. So all right, well, this has been episode 138 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying I want a montage of the War Doctor blowing up Daleks to "We're Not Going to Take It."
Yeah, a Twisted Sister.
That's what I need to see.
But mark your calendars, kids, because this is Keir saying that Haley's forthcoming EP entitled Time to Start Talking drops next week. So put in your pre-orders now and listen to all the things that she doesn't have to say.
We'll see you guys next week.
We'll see.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.